Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. Listen in as we discuss all things business, growth, and marketing with business owners, thought leaders, and entrepreneurs. And now, here's your host, founder of Roundhouse, the creative agency, Saul Edmonds.
Oh, hey, everyone. Welcome to the Grow Your Business podcast. I've got Chris Dyer speaking with me today from the other side of the world. Chris, how are you today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on your show.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Where are you again?
I'm in Orange County, California, just a stone's throw from the Mouse House or Disneyland, you might want to call it. So I'm in another part of the sunny world as you, I guess.
Yeah, that's right. What's the is it night or morning for you? I think it's evening, isn't it?
Yeah, it's the afternoon. So it's 2 o'clock my time right now.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. No, it's morning over here. I do this so often, but I generally know sort of times now in the different parts of the world, but I sort of slip in and out of East Coast, West Coast, Europe, sort of England. So anyway, it's really great to have you on the podcast today. Before we get into, all the various different things we're going to talk about, what I usually sort of say to people is, for people who don't know who you are, what you get up to, could you just give everyone a little bit of a snapshot about what you actually do? And then I guess like a little short annotated history about, you know, your journey to this point. How did you get here?
Yeah, so I ran an organization, human capital company, for many, many years. And I sold it at the end of 2021. And so, you know, during that time, we were getting a lot of attention for being a fastest growing company on the Inc. 5000 list 5 times. And people started, you know, asking me like, well, how do you grow so fast? And why, you know, do you have such high engagement scores at your company? And why do you keep people? And why does everyone want to work for you? And, you know, it was all about culture for us. It was all about how we interacted with people and how we actually very systematically and intentionally went about culture and really trying to make it work for everybody, not just work for me or not just work for the leaders, not just work for employees, but like literally work for everybody. And so for many years, that kind of put me on the road about talking and doing keynotes and things like that. But, you know, I was running a company with like thousands of employees. So if I did 15 extra keynotes a year, like, that was almost unbearable to be able to do because I was so busy. So I sold the company. It was like, well, now I'm ready to go. So that's what I spend my time, you know, full time. I go to speaking around the world, talking about culture, future of work, mastering key conversations. My organization just happened to also be fully remote. So during COVID, I did like 200 trainings with people around the world, big companies, you know, big government organizations that were like, how do we do this remote thing? Because they hadn't even considered the possibility that it would allow people to be remote. And so they came knocking on my door, you know, how do we do this? And it's funny that a lot of the lessons around culture and the things that we did very intentionally apply to remote work and hybrid work and all of that, like not having stupid meetings and not having like a ridiculous meeting culture and not, you know, wasting everybody's time with, you know, stupid communication and redundant communication and stuff that was just cover your butt and, you know, just trying to prove yourself or make sure your boss knew that you were working on something by calling 3 meetings. I mean, just removing all that stuff and giving people real abilities to show they've done a good job, right? The right way to show they've done a good job, not these, I call it the stupid way. So that's the sort of elongated short version of a very long story that I won't tell you everything of, but that's what I do today. So now I'm out speaking. I consult and help organizations that want to have less meetings, want to have a great culture, and ultimately want their people to be fully engaged. That's really what I'm all about, is help people get to that full engagement.
How do you actually find, that's an interesting point that you brought up there about remote work, and I don't think I've quite heard anyone sort of speak about the remote work thing in quite that sort of way, because I guess when all of that really started, I mean, it didn't obviously start during COVID because it was around before that, but as it was obviously a pretty big catalyst. But like the positive, you know, sort of spin on what people initially were like, oh no, that's going to mean, maybe they didn't even know what that was going to mean yet, right? You know, when they were like, oh, it's going to completely change things. We won't be able to, you know, really communicate in the way that we're used to communicating. Like how did you find, say, for some businesses or different company cultures, how much of a struggle was that to get past that and like the transition from doing that all the time and that being the norm over to, was there a level of convincing people that that was going to be okay? Or did you and then you know, other people just have to go through that process and have those realizations themselves? Like how did some people respond to that? Was it fear? Was it, you know, they don't really care? Or,
you know, the pandemic sort of removed so many obstacles and it removed so many objections and it removed a lot of the things that are traditionally there during change management. It was, you have to do this, so go figure it out.
Right.
And, you know, typically it's like if a CEO came in and was like, now we're going to go remote work, and all the leaders are going, whoa, slow down. And like they can do things to kind of like sabotage and make things go slower. You know, they take all their old ways of doing things, sort of applying it to the new thing. You didn't have that. It was like, well, today we were here and tomorrow
you had to do it.
Better figure it out. And like, oh my gosh, well, let's go find out how to go do this. Like, who knows how to do this? And so the smart companies were out getting people who actually did this before and learning how to do it new. So, I mean, it's a silly example, but I mean, imagine if like suddenly it became illegal to ride a horse back when everyone was on horses. And then like at the very next day, everyone had a car. Like, you wouldn't say, well, can I put the saddle in my car and can I, you know, still feed it an apple? Like, you'd be like immediately, well, no, I need to learn how to drive a car. You would just, your whole mindset would shift, right? And you know, you wouldn't care anymore about the stupid horse because you have a car. And for a lot of organizations, remote work was better. It was faster. It was more productive. And once you learn the differences, right, we saw the highest productivity in history during the pandemic. Organizations.
Yeah, interesting. Crazy. Interesting, isn't it? Like it sort of gets back to the fear of change, I guess, doesn't it? Too. Yeah. But like you said, it's like once you have to do it, there's an element of that for me, which is a bit like, you know, what sort of often has to happen in sport is because you don't, with the difference that's in real time, is that you've got to do something and you're trying to win a match or you're trying to win a race. And you have to adapt, like you don't have any choice. Like you either go, okay, I'm just going to give in. I mean, that's the difference there, is that it's just a race to be the winner. But in the same time, it's kind of a have to situation. You either do it or you don't. And there's no sort of chat around it and all that. So am I correct in sort of assuming that like with your original business that you were talking about before, was there like a strong element of remote work there already, or was that something that you had to go through as well?
Yeah, so back in 2008 when we had the big recession that happened with the mortgage crisis, that's when I took my company fully remote. So originally, gosh, I had planned on doing it just temporarily so that we could shed the big expensive lease on the building and get rid of all these expenses. And I wanted to be able to keep my people, not have to lay them off. So we said, we'll just send everybody home temporarily, maybe for a year, maybe 6 months, maybe 2 years. And within 2 weeks, like every one of my people that I talk to on a regular basis in my company, all those people had called me and said, please don't ever make us go back. This is the best thing we've ever done. All of my direct reports, all my employees are saying, this is the best thing we've ever done. And I was scratching my head going, huh, like I didn't see that coming. Like I thought everyone was going to be suffering at home, and instead they were thriving at home. And so we had it all figured out by the time the pandemic came around.
Interesting. So how much of a, like in the grand scheme of, you know, people, companies, maybe similar to yours or just other similar sized companies. How much of an early adopter now in retrospect were you, like, for when you did that? Was that like a really early new thing in 2008?
Yeah. So in 2008, like, there were some examples of people doing it, but it was mostly reserved for startups. You know, people thought about early stage startups doing remote work, that kind of thing. And that was sort of almost like not frowned upon, but sort of like, well, they haven't grown up yet. Like, they'll grow up one day and they'll get their own little building, you know?
Yeah.
And so we actually had to hide it. Like, we pretended we had an office. We had one, like, an actual office in a building where we rented. There was like lots of other businesses in there. And that's where the mail went. And we had one person that went in there and picked up the mail and that kind of thing. But we pretended, and if somebody wanted to show up, like, we pretended that was our office and went in the conference room. That rarely happened. But a few years after that, it became like less of an issue. It's like people kind of got more used to it and the technology tools got better. But like, when I started, we were using Skype to communicate with each other. I mean, we were like, it was really primitive. Like, we had this thing called like 1-800. I don't know, like, it was like an 800 number to like all get on a conference call together, like wherever we were. And it was freeconferencecall.com. That's what it was. And, you know, we used these really crappy, unreliable tools that, you know, by the time the pandemic rolled around, like, people had Zoom. That was amazing that they had that. You know, they could share a screen and stuff. And that was not things we had when we started.
Isn't that interesting how, just on a slightly separate topic, it's kind of like the difference between when people shift over from a service that relates to a specific sort of change, and it, you know, it's like not exactly the same thing, but similar, like immediate or very quick shift from like MySpace to Facebook, when people go, we're using MySpace, and then all of a sudden overnight, everyone, or almost overnight, everyone seems to shift, and it's like you've got Skype, which is, because I used to use Skype all the time too, for everything, and it seemed fine. And then all of a sudden there's some catalyst, and it's COVID, and everyone is, I mean, maybe it was opportunistic by Zoom, or just generally they're, you know, because I think they generally are better overall with everything that they do, but everyone's like, oh, we're spending heaps more time at home and we're doing all these conference calls all the time. And then there's this sort of shift, and then next thing you know, it's like it's a different version of just company culture, but on a broader scale where everyone's culture is around these things. It's like a shared sort of similarity, I guess, isn't it? You know, in a way. But you're so tell us a little bit about you've written two books, right? You've got
three, actually. I get an upgrade. Yeah.
Oh, what's the third one?
Well, so my first book that I did was called The Power of Company Culture. Then I did the remote work book. Got really lucky and released that right as COVID happened. And then my third book is actually the second edition of the first book, but it is twice as big. So right. I kind of consider a different book because I doubled the size. We added a lot of cool case studies with Gary Vaynerchuk's company, NASA, Neiman Marcus, a lot of really cool organizations to kind of give people a lot more meat and a lot more depth to really understanding how to have a great culture.
Yeah. So with when did you write the first book? When was that written?
Oh, let's see. That would be, you're stretching my memory here. I'm trying to remember. So this last one was 2020 was the other one. So it must've been 2017, 2018, I think 2018 maybe. Was the first book.
Right. Okay. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? I constantly catch myself going, it's 2024, and I keep on feeling like it's still at the start of the 2000s. It sounds like I always feel, being a big Blade Runner fan, I always feel sort of strange then to think this was kind of around when actually Blade Runner was set before this, and we still don't, LA still doesn't look quite like it does in Blade Runner, I don't believe. Haven't been there recently, but I don't think it does. I noticed also that you had work with a number of, I had a look at your website, which is, being a web designer myself, I do admire like other nice websites, and it's a great site, by the way, really good sort of information, looks great for your brand. But I was scrolling down, I noticed that you had worked with some gaming development companies like Blizzard, and my mind straight away, being not recently still a StarCraft fan, but used to be a big StarCraft sort of person, my mind straight away was like, oh, that's interesting. I'm going to have to ask Chris about his experience with that company or companies like that, where there are developers, a lot of developers, and this different mix of people, if there's any sort of interesting, different, standout kind of things working with a company like that than that, as opposed to other places.
Yeah, I mean, so anytime that you have people with specialties in an organization, I find that, you know, that's going to take the culture in a very specific way. So you could have engineers, you could have software engineers, you could have mathematicians, you could have, I mean, there's just, you go and need like really good architects, you could have any sort of really specialized thing, especially when it brings us into that STEM world, right? That you tend to need to think about some things a little bit differently. And one of them is, you know, how do we communicate effectively? How are we thinking about our neurodivergent people? And we should be thinking about that all the time, but especially in those situations, right? We can end up losing great people, burning them out, and having really bad communication with them when we don't understand what they really need from us as leaders, or, you know, as their boss or whatever. And it's so often like somebody who is not, has no understanding of people who maybe have those sort of needs ends up being their boss, right? And they're like an extrovert like me, and they're over communicating at them. And then like, they're wondering, well, why don't they ever talk on meetings? And then, you know, why aren't they happy? Because they need something different. So we have to be really intentional. I often like to say that one size fits one. And people are always looking for the answer that's one size fits all. Can I just get this one thing and take it off the shelf? And like, that can be my culture, please. Or that can be my leadership style. And one size fits one. We have to figure out what makes sense for us and our people, and then apply really good practices and standards. And I have those in my book of like, what are the big umbrella things you need to think about? But ultimately, you're going to come up with your own version of that. And so Activision, Blizzard, King, I mean, they're really good examples of that. And my work with them recently, with a lot of their new leaders, and I think a lot of this sort of came from, you know, Microsoft now being a part of that world, trying to get them to really think about leadership in a more elevated way, because now these organizations are going to be asked to be bigger and better and stronger than they were before.
Yeah, no, that's interesting, because I've been being I'm you know, somewhere between a designer and a developer myself, like having worked with a lot of different sorts of people, like engineers and a lot of software developers. They're just not there. I don't know if it's probably too broad to say they're all introverts, because they're not, but they have their own sort of culture, and I kind of and they think about things a particular way. So like with that, say if you had to define, Chris, like say I'm a complete newbie to the idea of company culture, you know, just assume like I'm talking about company culture. I'm like, what's that? Like, what are you talking about? How would you explain to somebody, say, the difference between company culture and what you were talking about before, where it's, you still have to tailor things to those individual people's needs? If someone has a confusion about those two things, how would you explain it to them?
So the technical explanation is that company culture is the norms. It's the way in which we get things done. It's how we meet. It's how we communicate. But it's like, how do we actually get from point A to point B on a project? Are we in 5,000 meetings? Do I have to get 19 approvals from 35 different bosses? Like, you know, what does that look like? Or is it, hey, you know, go figure it out. Your boss just shows you, here, go do this project, go figure it out. Like, those are very different approaches to how something might happen. And I often try to, if people aren't quite sure what that means, you know, you probably had some friends in school that you were friends with for a long enough period of time that you knew them, you went to their house, and you also know that, like, they ended up okay. They went to school, they have decent jobs, and they have families now, and, like, they're decent human beings, and they turned out fine, right? But when you went to their house, you remember that this one family, it was a very different vibe than your house. Sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a bad way, right? Like, this friend's family was, like, super strict and, like, type A. And your other buddy, like, his parents were hippies. It didn't care what you did. But, like, in the end, they all turned out okay. And they all ended up, you know, being able to get a real career and a real job and have families and, like, be a normal, you know, person in society. Which family structure was best? I don't know. But that culture of that house was different. But the minimum things, like, that allowed them to grow up to be successful human beings, those things were the same no matter what household you went to, right? They kept their kids safe. They made sure they valued education. You know, like, there were certain things that they did, even if they did it in their own way. And so you've got to just decide, how do you want to run your house? How do you want to run your company? You know, and there isn't, I can tell you which one I think is best, but there technically isn't one correct answer. There's just getting the important stuff really, really right.
That's interesting. That's a really good way of explaining it. I can imagine, I watched a few little things on your site with you, sort of speaking. I would imagine I can sort of envision in my mind with how you're explaining that, how that would resonate with people at like an event with the way those sort of metaphors are good, and it's an easy way for people to relate to them straight away, right? You know, with, like, their families, I straight away, as soon as you said that, I was transported back. I was actually transported back immediately to this event that I actually just thought of it as soon as you said that. I probably haven't thought of it in years. I think I was, like, in primary school. I was probably about 10, and I went over for the first time to my friend's place, and he was Chinese, and their culture was, like, really, I mean, it was exactly like you said, was very similar in a lot of ways, but there was this real formality which I had never experienced after dinner.
Right.
And there was an expectation, and I had no idea this was the case. And I remember it distinctly, was I was meant to, and my friend was like, you have to go up to our parents and you sort of have to say this. And I didn't understand, like, why. And it made me nervous. Yeah. And it made me so nervous. I remember at the time that I refused to do it. And of course it became, you know, this big thing at the time. And that was just, I was transported straight away back to that. I was like, interesting. That's actually, like, you know, those little things that everything else is kind of really similar. And then there's these, like, few little things that really jump out. And you see that, I guess, in, when people, like, when there's language barriers and things too, like in different, companies where there's hybrid work too, what sort of like outside of the really obvious things of certain cultural things that aren't translated, how do you sort of assist? What are a few key things where someone's having huge problems with, you know, ongoing language issues or cultural issues? What are some top sort of key things that you start the conversation around helping that? Like, how do you start that process to move forward?
Well, if the question is, like, how do we have better conversations? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. And well, yeah, I guess in the sense of there's, so say the scenario is you have a large workforce and a lot of them are comprised of some sort of overseas people, and there's a few language problems in terms of, and then the actual cultural things that nobody really understands why people are doing things a certain way. Like if someone's from, you know, the Philippines or something or elsewhere, and they haven't had any experience with a different hybrid workforce.
Yeah.
What are the things that you start to do in order to help those things become solved, I guess, and in improve? Like, what do you have to do?
Yeah, I mean, so there's a few things. I mean, one, we can make sure that we have deeper understandings. And so sometimes that's just like, can we choose something and can we talk about why this is different and give people the empathy and understanding, right? So like, had your friend's parents or your parents told you that, hey, there may be this totally different thing that's going to happen at your friend's house when you go over there, you would have been prepared and you would have been, okay, I understand why this is different. And you could adjust, but you know, you were a kid, but like the average person gets brand new job and get thrown into something they don't understand and they don't know why it's happening this way. They do the same reaction you did, right? It's just like, I don't know about this. I don't want to do it. You know, I'm not comfortable. And we can lose people, right? When we hire people, they'll make up their minds in the first hour of a brand new job if they're going to make it the whole day. And in the first day, they're going to decide whether they're going to make it 2 weeks. And that first 2 weeks, they're going to decide if they're going to make it 6 months. I mean, they're making these little decisions at these little moments of like, am I going to stay or am I going to start looking for another job?
Mm.
Right. And so we have to make sure they really understand that. Now, if we're talking about how to be more effective, I have seen that a lot of times if we can use an AI is really going to help with this. We use note takers. We used to like take, you know, regular notes. And then when note takers became possible, we started using that. And so everyone got a copy of it. And then they could take that. And now the note takers will do it for you. They could take it and translate it into their native language, which is huge, right? Because they're hearing it in a second language. That's a little bit different than reading it in your own. I know I've had a lot of assistants from around the world, and I would have calls with them and they would tell me they understood. And then I would send them on their way and they'd come back to me and it was like, you did not understand. Why didn't you ask me for help? Why didn't you ask questions? And I realized they thought they understood.
Yes.
Yeah. Right. It wasn't that they didn't. They thought they did. And so what I would, if I sent them good notes, and if I sent them a video explaining it so they could watch it again, but if I sent them written instructions, they tended to give a deeper understanding because then again, they could translate, they could look things up, they could learn in their own language. So those are a few ways that we can think about it. Now, you can also, as a third kind of thing, is look at the country's norms. If you, this is a big problem for Americans, we go anywhere else, and we'll start using sports jargon. So we'll start saying things like, that came out of left field. In America, that is a very normal thing to say. To most other people, they're like, what are you talking about left? What does that mean? And that means that it's a baseball terminology. Hmm. And it means that it came out of nowhere. But if we go in and start using all this jargon that only we understand, we are going to eliminate our ability to be able to effectively communicate with people. And so, you know, that idea sounds like a home run. What does that mean? Mm. Right. I mean, and we're a little bit lucky that like people tend to watch American shows and American movies like that, but still it gets lost in translation in a lot of ways, especially those deep colloquialisms and jargon and things like that. So can we eliminate all of that from our business conversations and try to be very clean and direct about what we're saying? Because that usually really ramps it up and helps people understand better.
Yeah, true. Actually, exactly the same thing, but from the Australian perspective, I remember years ago, and it was one of the first times I've had a lot of chats over the years with friends and clients in the States and with different parts of people, like they, you know, I guess I'm flowing on from what you're saying. Some of those people are aware of some Australian jargon, you know, like no worries, you know, saying no worries. And I remember one time years ago on Skype, a long time ago, I was having a chat to a lady from New York. And in the conversation, I said, I was saying part of a sentence, and then and she said something, and I said, no worries. And there was this really long pause, and she said, what are you worried about? And so, and I was like, oh, and it almost short circuited my brain. And I was like, oh, and then I had to, and then I realized as soon as she said that, I was like, okay, I said, no, it's just a sort of a slang word. And I sort of explained it. And she was like, but what are you worried about? And I said, I'm not worried. And then I had to go through this whole sort of thing about, and I said, look, it's just a silly Australian thing. Let's just, you know, let's just move on.
Have you not heard of Bob Marley? No worry. Oh, come on.
No worries. No, that's right. So yeah, it's, but you don't think about these things, right? And you're just in the swing of things. And I think like that idea of being intentional, then flowing onto language, is something that I guess most of us don't need to do in everyday life, because you're around other people that get it, and it's not, it doesn't jump out at you as like something that is causing an issue, or because unless somebody says something about it, or then even if they do, like you said before, like people don't, you realize that some of those people do actually think they understood it. And then, you know, but so just on, say, when you started this journey too, Chris, outside of the fact that there was a scenario that I guess forced you in a way to, you know, to start thinking more about remote work and company culture, even before that, was there some part of you that you've been able to, I guess, reflect on or identify in the past that gave you, or that sort of assisted you in this passion that you now have for company culture, like even before those other catalysts? Was there something else, you know, like,
and this may be helpful. Yeah, this may be helpful for people, especially as it relates to the title of your podcast, and trying to think about how do we grow and how do we get better, right? And I remember everyone telling me I needed, and society kind of pushing on me as a young entrepreneur, that I should be getting better at the things that I'm not good at, that I should be inherently worried about my weaknesses, that I should be trying to improve my weaknesses, that, you know, it's this whole like self-help community and all this stuff. Like, you know, if you're bad at this thing, then you better be spending a lot of time on that. And, you know, my handwriting's terrible. People always told me I need to work on my penmanship, you know, these kinds of things. And so I remember just kind of being intrigued by this question, because what I noticed about high performers was they were riddled with gigantic weaknesses. They had like overly strong in an area, and then like had huge deficits in other areas. They weren't well-rounded individuals most of the time. And so I'm like, well, the world's telling me to go be this well-rounded person with decent strengths and not too many weaknesses, but that's not what I'm seeing with the people who do really, really well. And so I started asking, I started going to conferences, talking to, you know, the most successful people in the room, the speakers in the room, like anyone who I thought, you know, was one of these people. And I would ask them, should I worry about or try to get better at the things that I'm weak at? And they would always tell me yes. And then my follow-up question was, but do you do that? And you could see the little wheels spinning in their head and them going like, oh, they hadn't realized it, because they were going along with the mantra that the rest of the world had been telling me, even though they didn't do it, but they were still repeating this BS, you know, this just ridiculous stuff. And they were like, no, I don't. I get other people to do the stuff I'm not good at. You know, I outsource that. You know, I focus on just what I like and what I'm good at, and I don't do any other stuff. And I was like, aha, And so that was like the first big kind of like aha moment for me to go, I need to start being really intentional and do the things I'm really good at. And anything that comes across my desk that I'm not good at, that doesn't give me passion, that doesn't make me excited to get out of bed, that goes to somebody else. Now, not just delegated away, but to someone who says, that's an amazing thing. I would love to do that, Chris. Right? I hated bookkeeping. I was doing the bookkeeping in my business because I was like, well, can't really afford like a proper accountant and I can just do it. I hate it. Immediately got a bookkeeper and it was like the, you know, the this great parting of the sea. It was like, oh my gosh, I have so much more headspace. I have so much more energy every day to go and do sales calls and come up with new solutions because I'm not sitting mindlessly punching in bills and numbers and things I hate. You know, So that was kind of the big thing for me. And that, I think that's a big realization for CEOs, for leaders, for anyone out there who's a salesperson. Like, don't do the crap that drains your energy. It's just, it's killing your productivity.
So was that a little bit of chicken and the egg too? Because what I sort of like, you know, hear you saying, and you can sort of say whether you think this is true or not, is that like the fact that then you freed up the time helped you to realize what the real passion was. Is that right?
Like yeah, it was both. I mean,
yeah,
it was
both. Sort of, yeah, you did know that, but then you realized it more because then you were doing less of the other things.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it became like, so I mean, if you want to put this in terms of like, I did the defense first, right? I put the moat around my castle and said, I'm not letting in any more of the stuff that I don't want to do that drains me. Mm. And then, you know, and discovering and realizing other people loved doing some of the stuff that I hated was like, so I almost felt like guilty in the beginning. Well, I'm just giving them the stuff I don't want to do. And it was like, no, they want to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
My bookkeeper was like, I love doing this. I love organizing and getting all together and creating reports. And I'm like, you're insane, but here you go. Like, please take it from me.
Yeah, no, it's true. And I love that. Like, I love when you see, that's actually one of the best things about, you know, my job working with different, like completely different sorts of industries and businesses is I have these realizations. It still happens. Like after working with so many different types of people that people are really into, like, you know, hydrology or like water management or like all these like we've worked for some strange reason over the years a number of times with, you know, engineers who specialize in water management and flood risk and all these things, and they're like super into it. They write papers on it, and I find that stuff absolutely fascinating that people are into these like really I'm excited about that, not because I'm into the same thing, but because I like when I hear people talking about it and you can like hear how excited they get about certain things. And that's really cool. And like when you are able to, then identify that, is that then a part also of, say, if you're talking about leadership and you would be, I mean, I imagine like you speaking with leaders about like how to, you know, how to either create or how to identify things in company culture that are, you know, important or things they need to sort of improve on. How difficult or, you know, what sort of interesting strategies are sometimes need to be implemented for people to realize, I'm saying like a leader to go to actually realize what, if appropriate, someone's passion is, or to, you know, to put them in that sort of slot more, or to even know that in the first place. I'm like, how do they do that? Like, it's obviously talking to them, but are there other ways to do that?
I used to ask everyone who reported directly to me, you know, a few questions a few times a year. And that was like, what are like the five things you're working on that are giving you the most passion right now that you're really excited about? What are the five things that are absolutely just draining you, that are causing you to feel run down or burnt out or whatever. And sometimes I could help them with that, and sometimes I couldn't. You know, but I would get them to sort of identify these things. And then I would realize sometimes that one person would say, well, I'm dealing with this thing and I hate it. And then someone else would say, I'm dealing with this thing that's really similar and I love it. Right. And I would be like, hey, I get them together and say, hey, John, I noticed you hate doing this report. Jane, you said you love doing this report. How about we move it over here to you? Is there something you can give to John? Like, we'll make this equal. And like, usually they were like ecstatic. Like, I'm playing matchmaker with their stuff. And I didn't worry about like titles so much. It could be like they end up doing a report that doesn't make a lot of sense based on their title, you know, officially. But that task or that thing or that dealing with these certain kind of clients, whatever, we could kind of move those responsibilities around and we could figure out how we could help them with that. It also would sometimes, I would ask this other question of like, what activities have you taken on in the last, I used to like every 3 or 4 months, like what new activities have you taken on? And they would let me know, because inevitably they would agree to do something, or they're going to mentor this person, or they're going to start running this report, or they're managing this new client, whatever. And then when they would, if they added on one thing or something, I didn't worry about it, but there was like 3, 4, 5, 6 things that they've added on in the last few months. My next question back to them was, well, what did you remove? What did you stop doing? And even though I did this on a consistent basis, it still would stop them in their tracks. They would be like, oh, nothing. I'm still doing all the same other things. And I'm like, listen, as your boss, you cannot take on 6 more things and still be effective and for me to expect to keep you. Because typically what happens to our high performers is they keep taking on more. People keep coming to them and giving them more and more and more because they're so good.
And they get burnt out.
Right. And then they get burnt out. And the only way for them to get out of this hole is to leave and to go somewhere else where they start at zero again. And then they just keep taking on more and more and more and more and more until they can go get a job somewhere else, right? Maybe for more money, maybe for a different title. But I've asked high performers who've left before, did you really want to leave the other company? And they were like, no, you know, but like, I couldn't do it. It was too much. I was burnt out. I needed a break. You know, I was making really great money. I loved my clients. And like, you never thought to just take away work.
That seems like a super important thing to identify, but is it something that is often not identified? Because that seems like a really...
It's never identified. No one ever says like, you know, there's always that thing we thought you would never stop doing that suddenly not just didn't become important anymore. But if we don't name it and identify it and say, you know what, we don't really need that report anymore. I'm not sure anyone's looked at it in a year. Like, if we need to restart that again, we'll restart it. But like, let's just stop doing that, you know, or you kept having that client meeting because that client used to be a jerk, but now they seem to be okay now. Like, how about we stop doing that activity, you know? And it's amazing how 99% of the time it was like nothing changed. We just stopped doing the thing. We got rid of it. Sometimes we had to give it to somebody else. And this was a good way to delegate, to help a person on their team learn new things and to level them up and teach them how to do the thing or take over this report or this client, whatever. And, you know, my people just kept like taking on more and more. So that was one of our strategies to really keep people for a very long time, is to make sure that the amount of work that they're going to do is about the same this year as it's going to be next year.
It sounds like the problem that, you know, farmers who kind of over farm, you know, a sort of a piece of land, the land's going to eventually become barren, or the quality of the land's going to, and then they just got to leave. They're going to move on to a new field, right? And so it's going to become like over farm. And you don't realize often, I mean, I'm not a farmer, but, you don't realize that's the case often. Say like you really want to get these crops, you really want to do this stuff, and you're just in the thick of it, and unless somebody comes along from the field, like your farmer mate next door or the your boss and goes, hey, like I noticed something about, you know, what's going on. Your yield is looking a little bit thin, like the corn stalks are a little bit floppy, you know, or sort of whatever, like, you know, to have that extra voice going, maybe you should think about this is, yeah, I mean, it kind of doesn't surprise me now that when you're talking about it, that's the case because people are busy and they want to do well and they're probably like genuinely enjoying it, right? Like they're still kind of because they're, especially if they're, you know, hardworking and, you know, and a high performing person in that particular role. And they actually genuinely enjoy the task and they're like, yeah, it's all right, I can take on more. But then it's sort of, it all happens too quickly. And, you know, thinking about it, unless someone goes, whoa, just, you know, hold on a second, you know, so is that how important is how, I guess, significant is that point we were just talking about in terms of retention? Would you say that's one of like the key points or is
it? It's a huge part of retention for your top people. You know, the people you want to keep the most, we need to make sure that they are not getting burnt out. And they take that on as a badge of honor that they do all these things and they get the awards and they get the recognition. But I guarantee if you go back and look at some of your top performers and you look at how much vacation they've taken, I'll bet you it's less this year than it was last year. I'll bet you they've taken less days off because they are trying to keep up with that expectation and keep up with that vision they have of themselves as this person who can get everything done. And, you know, and I don't remember if you have the same problem in Australia as we do here, but in the States, it's common for people never to take their vacations and they almost like brag about it. They just don't ever, you know, and it's insanity. And I remember I had my top sales guy, he had like 3 good years in a row. And on year 4, we saw like, it was rolling around Q4 and he was not having a great year. And I called him up and I said, hey, when's the last time you took vacation? He was like, oh, it wasn't this year. I don't think I took maybe more than a day or two last year. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like you haven't taken a full. I'm like, okay, right now, go call your wife. You guys are going on vacation. I'm like, no staycations. You guys need to go somewhere. You need to go. Get out of here. And he's like, I got to make my I said, I don't care. You're not getting fired. Go take a vacation for 2 weeks and then come back. And it was amazing when he came back, he was like, his brain had like settled. He had a thousand other better ideas. He ended up making his number, you know, like it came out of nowhere. And from then on, like we just started like really pushing on our people that they have to take their vacations unless they wanted to save it up for some special thing or getting married or they needed to like, I don't know, they're going to have surgery.
Yeah.
Right. Or something, you know, like we were really adamant. If you get 2 weeks, you need to take your 2 weeks. Like we want, and we prefer that you take, you know, at least a week at a time. Like you know, we don't want you to take like one day off here and one day off. Like we want you to be not thinking about work for a significant period of time because you're actually going to be better for everybody when you come back. And that was hard for a lot of people.
Yeah. I guess does that relate to just generally habits and the perception about what people think is I guess even worthwhile, you know, too, like that, those sort of habits. Cause people, I mean, I'm sure I'm the same with certain things. And I mean, even on a day to day basis, when you go, cause I'm generally, sort of try to have the habit of, because I'm sitting down at the computer, like a lot of people are most of the time, I've now like tried to form this habit, which sometimes then I slip out of. And it's like of just hopping up and having a short walk, like 5-minute walk. That's it. You know, like every hour, just have a walk, you know, just do something physical. But then it's easy to slip out of that because you're like, oh, I'm busy. I've got to get this stuff. And it's like, oh, it's only 5 minutes. Like that's ridiculous. That's a silly thing to think, but they're those habits to break. But on just another sort of topic, Chris, about your speaking, what do you get out of like from a personal perspective, what do you find that you get out of when you're sort of speaking to people? What are like the takeaway sort of things? Like, you're in front of a group of people, it's probably different for different groups, but are there certain things that really stand out that after a event that you're like, wow, that's like a common wonderful thing that I either feel or think? What are some of those things?
Yeah, you know, I'm always very proud. It's very common for people to say they actually feel like the things that I talked about and that I taught them were actionable, that they could really go back and use them. I've seen a lot of great speakers who get you all riled up and get you excited, and you walk out of the room going, yeah, I'm going to go do this thing. And then you realize you have no idea how to do it. Unless you go buy their course, their book, and even then, like, do I really know how to do it? And so my goal is always to make sure that I'm providing whoever's in the audience real actionable things, stories that they can enjoy, very approachable way to understand, like my seven pillars of culture, but then real life practical things they can do. And we've talked about some of these practical things they can do, right? Just asking people if, you know, did you take on more tasks and how many did you get rid of? I mean, that's a very practical thing you could do, right? To go back and could ask everyone on your team that right away, you know, and find out if who's burnt out. Go back and look and see when people have, how much vacation time they've taken. That'll tell you if they're burnt out or not, you know, if they're on their way. So that's typically like one of the areas that I hear a lot of. Also that people feel like it's almost like a, not an aha moment, but it's like a duh moment of like, I should have realized that. Like, I'm not telling people the secret nuclear codes. I'm not like coming to you with information that only exists in my brain and three other people in the world, but I'm trying to package it in a way that you go, ah, that makes sense. I can do that. You know, I should have thought of that myself, but I didn't, but I'm glad I know it now. So those are probably kind of the two big things that I hear commonly.
Yeah, actually, I could sort of, I feel like that perhaps we've only like met for the first time, but like, you know, knowing that you had this other business and you had to, you know, probably talk to a lot of people a lot, you know, just through, it's obviously a part of you as well that's is probably a lot more predisposed to that sort of activity perhaps, but then just the practice of having to do it all the time, I feel like that's probably a really good thing for being a speaker too, in the way that the things that you sort of like people to get out of it are like similar things, that there's like real things that they can do. Like, you're obviously a, you know, speaker there, you know, there's sort of help to motivate and educate and all that sort of stuff. Like I guess like most speakers are, but yeah, at the end of the day, you want people to be able to like have genuine real world help, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I want them to feel like they can go back and make, you know, those incremental changes. And that's what it's all about. It's about small changes over a long period of time. I'm not asking people to, you know, go and make some just gigantic change that's going to disrupt their entire business and cause chaos. I'm saying, how can you get like 1% better today or this week or this month or whatever that means? Like, how can you get a little bit better? What's the thing I can do today to help my team get a little bit better, work a little bit better, be a little less stressed out? And all of those little 1%, they start stacking on each other.
Yeah.
And it makes a big difference, and it makes a much bigger difference than, hey, everyone, we're going to go change the one of our words that, you know, was our company motto or whatever, and that's going to solve the problem. We're going to, you know, have 19 webinars on this and tell our clients and redo our logo. And like, no, let's just keep stacking on top of goodness. And you're going to turn around and go like, whoa, our company looks different. Our people are happier. We're making more money. Productivity's up. Performance is up. Profits are up. And you get addicted to that, you want to keep going.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's wonderful. It's interesting too, because I guess like a lot of topics and terms that people hear all the time, like in the business world, when you go on LinkedIn or anywhere and people are talking about, you know, motivation this, you know, performance that, and all these sort of things. And you can very easily get, I guess once you hear things too many times, you can sort of get immune to them and then not see the potential, like, real value. It's sort of like things you're talking about, which, like, you know, I always tend to gravitate to, like, I like a good, you know, metaphor, and I like a good, you know, imbuing things with meaning and all that. But at the end of the day, if you can combine that with just real world things that you can implement, like in that, I guess it's once again for me similar in like a sport way, like you do things that have that either work or then they don't work, and you can see them sort of clearly, and you're able to then, you know, even pass them on to other people. Have you had, and I guess on that subject too, have you found like there's been, you know, some good flow on effect, like with say somebody comes to and hears you speak, or you're talking to a business and everyone's there, that there's then after the fact, after you've left, that there's a good you know, flow on effect with people, like have these ideas and these simple sort of things to pass on to other people then too?
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, whether it's I'm talking about how to have meetings differently, I often give people these like very unique, special kind of meetings they should think about having in their company. Or I talk to them about not having any more one-on-one meetings. Like, how many one-on-one meetings can you get rid of today? Because that will probably make your life a lot better. I think one-on-one meetings are stupid in most instances. Yes, working on a project, HR issue, coaching, training, one-on-one, sure. But like the standard one-on-one, because you're my boss and we're going to meet on Monday at 3, is stupid. We should be meeting in teams. We should be talking about these things together. We shouldn't be waiting to make decisions until I meet with you on Monday at 3, because you know you're going to cancel anyways on me like half the time. And it's going to be a totally worthless meeting because you're running around with your head cut off and I'm running around with my head cut off, and we're not really going to talk about my goals. Like, some of these things we think we're supposed to be doing are actually kind of ruining productivity. So when I give them some of these things to think about, they tend to, you know, either jump in and like want to jump in the deep end and want to do it, or they resist and go, no, you're wrong. But then they want to talk about it, right? And then they kind of figure out where they think they sit on that issue. And that's just thinking about that sometimes is enough to really help them.
Yeah. So what are some, as we're getting towards the pointy end, I guess, of the podcast, like, are there any really, there's like a lot of different, you know, things. You have the different 7 pillars and all that sort of stuff that we just touched on, but that if you had to say just, you know, 1 or 2 really key things as like a sort of a parting note to people listening about things that they should be thinking about, that they're running a business, they've got staff, what would those things be, Chris?
I mean, what's really important is that people realize that probably 2 things. I gave you kind of like 2 quotes or 2 things that might be helpful that I always like to remind people of. The first one is, design what you want or deal with what you get. So do you want a happy company? You want people who thank each other? Do you want a cutthroat winner takes all? Like, whatever it is you want, you got to go design it. Or else you're going to be stuck with what other people decide your culture is. You know, and the other one is, what you focus on grows. So if you're constantly focused on what the bad employees in your mind, or the ones that aren't making their number, or the ones that score lower with the customer, like if you're worried about them and that's like all of your focus, that's just going to get worse. I know that sounds counterintuitive, but you need to focus on what.
No, not really. No,
the best salespeople are doing, right? What are the best customer service people doing? And then get them to teach everybody else their secrets and what they do and how they do it. And if the other people at the bottom can't level themselves up by being given the keys to success and being shown the way to there, then you got to let them go and get somebody else, right? We don't have time. I've known so many sales managers that are like, as soon as someone's not making their number, they want to be copied on every email. They want to be on every call. They start micromanaging the crap out of them. And does that person ever get better? No. Maybe the VP of sales starts selling their deals for them, but like that person doesn't get any better. If you have them go and talk to the best salesperson, they're either going to get better or you're going to figure out you need to get rid of them. So what you focus on grows has always been this thing in my mind of like, am I focusing on the right things today? The things I want to get better. And when I do that and that gets better and that grows, everything else seems to take care of itself.
Mm, it does. Yeah, I think that's true. So I probably don't need to ask you for your quote, I guess, Chris. Quotes. So thank you. You slipped that in nicely and like it was a completely planned thing. So that was great. Thank you. Very seamless. Excellent. Good job.
There you go.
Yeah, no, thanks. No, they're great. They're really good things. I like the last one, especially what you focus on grows. And once again, like these things aren't, it's not really rocket science, is it? Like it's just really, I often find, I mean, maybe even in life too, but like these things all, you know, they're kind of, you know, in a way, like, you know, sort of life messages too. Like they're obviously very applicable to, you know, to teams and groups, but like that idea of putting your focus in the right place. It's also like you were talking about before. So putting your focus in the right place then also means not doing other things too. And yeah. Like, and knowing what you don't want or you don't like, and then not doing that if that's appropriate is the other side of the coin of what you focus on grows, really, isn't it? Like it's the two sides of the same coin because they're kind of interlinked. So I think that's a really great you know, way to wrap things up. But like for people, and we'll have the link also for your website in the description of the podcast too. But if you could just tell everyone what that is in your words, you can say the your URL, which is very easy to remember.
Sure. It's chrisdyer.com. So chrisdyer.com. I'm also on LinkedIn, TikTok, Instagram, wherever you hang out. I'm happy to connect. And I got all kinds of content out there that may be helpful.
That's fantastic. Thanks, Chris. It's a real pleasure. And I really hope, you know, people listening, I always have this, you know, hope, I guess it is like tied into the, like you touched on before, the title of the podcast, because I like to be able to like help people get their, like to grow like their message. And hopefully people, you know, listening will get something out of this and, you know, take some actionable steps, get in contact or, you know, whatever. But thanks again, Chris. And now it's your time to say goodbye to everybody listening, Chris.
Goodbye to everybody who's listening. Thanks so much for hanging on the podcast. And if you made it this far, congratulations. I mean, that's a good thing to make it this far. So great.
Yeah. Thanks, everyone. Thanks for making it this far. I really appreciate it. Thanks. See ya.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning in to today's episode of Grow Your Business. Have a great day, and we'll see you next time here at the Grow Your Business podcast.